Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is once again the navigator of the GNE, John Lash, and I'm recording on the 10th of October, 2012. I have a special feeling of excitement today making this recording on this particular occasion. It was 4 years ago today, on October 10th, 2008, that I received the secret Dakini name of Sophia in the Shakti cluster. And it was on this day, a beautiful, crisp, clear autumn day, as I recall, that I wrote the Gayan Tantric vow, that is the recitational part of the vow. Everyone who takes the GTV does it in their own way. You write your own language. You express your vow in your own words. But there is a procedure in doing the vow that I have suggested, and that procedure and everything contained in that ritual came into perfect and clear distillation of knowing 4 years ago today. So there was the secret Dakini name, and there was the recitational formula of the vow, that is to say, the reading of the names of some of the many, countless, hundreds of names given to the planetary animal mother. So it's exciting today. I feel grateful to be alive, grateful to have been there 4 years ago in the state of mind that allowed me to do what I did. A state of mind that I would describe as divine mania. And I feel also today, right now, a continuing rush of excitement from the experiment 5 days ago, test one with channel 16. Several of you who have written to me about that experiment used the words that I myself used in the previous briefing. Euphoria and crystal. So this is how we proceed in this experiment. This is how confirmation comes from each of you as a willing subject. The title of the previous talk was The Five-Pin Teleport. That was NB31. So this is nav briefing number 32. It is the continuation of that talk, and I'm calling this one Cooperative Freedom. Before I get into this talk, I'd also like to say that October 10th is not only the anniversary of the things just stated, but it's also the anniversary of my last meeting with my friend Jan Michelle Kerouac. That was in 1994 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Jan came up to see me from Albuquerque, where she was living. She actually came on the shuttle bus from the airport. I remember her stepping off the bus in front of the big hotel that had been built by these New York developers in the center of Santa Fe, in the place where there used to be a hardware store. And so we met on the steps of that hotel and went inside and had some blueberry cheesecake and a cup of coffee together. Jan died 18 months later, in June of 1996. It took me quite a while to get over that death, although I must say that the loss of my friend Jan, an incomparable friend, incomparable love, taught me that death is only half the truth. She certainly did die. I would never deny that. But she also didn't die. And the truth is that you die and you don't die. Both. The truth is both. It's both. And I have proof because I've seen Jan since she died. Just as alive and physically present as you or I right now. And I mention this for a couple of reasons. I feel always grateful for Jan, and I know that some of you do as well, because you understand that I can do what I do because of her. I would do it anyway, of course I would, because the trajectory of my destiny led me to be the navigator and to learn and teach in the way that I do. But the fact that I can do it with relative comfort and security comes from Jan, and so I say, thank you, Jan. The beginning of October always reminds me of that last meeting and reminds me of the death of her father, which happened in October. Jan had a special attachment to the month of October, and so did Jack Kerouac. When he wrote October in the Railroad Earth, it was like one of his scribblings that he never completed. Jan also loved the month of October. And just want to say for now that this talk is a follow-up to the previous one entitled The Five-Pin Teleport. And by that title, I'm suggesting that there is a teleport in the cosmos, that channel 16 is in some respect a teleport, as well as a telepathic transceiving device. And so the subject of teleportation comes up here. I was able to see Jan alive in a teleportation experience by going to that place where she continues to live. So I am convinced on the basis of my firsthand experience that when we die here on this planet, we continue to live elsewhere. So you both die and you do not die. And that is the correct way to think about death. It's not one or the other, it's both. The subject of teleportation and the plasmic double has been a lot on my mind since the experience of the 5th of October. Being on channel 16 has reactivated some of my own memories and some of my questions about the mysterious matter of the plasmic double, which is the vehicle of teleportation. Teachings about the plasmic double belong to the highest aspect of telestic shamanism, but at the same time, they touch on the most elementary facts of our existence as human animals, and especially as emotional animals and creatures of will, volition, and resolution. So let me give you a peek of what I'm rambling about here, if I might, before I get back into the main topic. The moment Jan died, I wasn't able to grieve that loss because of certain pressing circumstances I had to deal with, which Jan left me, unfinished business of hers. And it was difficult to take care of this business, and it's not my kind of thing to get involved in. But I did it, but it was extremely preoccupying and particularly disturbing to me due to all the anger that came up over quite a while, over several years. For about 4 years after she died, I was in a state of enormous anger in regard to the circumstances of her death and people who had contributed to her anxiety and the terrible sense of abandonment she suffered from due to the way she was treated by her father, Jack Kerouac. So I was dealing with all that, as you say, and it only came to the time when I retreated to the little shepherd's cottage near Arc in southern France, November of 1999. It only came to that moment when I was alone there during that winter when it rained torrentially that I was able to grieve the loss of my friend. And I'll tell you what is so important about grieving the loss of people. You can hold in your mind, you can hold in your heart, if you will, the resolute conviction that you die and do not die at the same time. But that doesn't mean that you don't grieve the loss of someone who dies. Grief is an event of the double, of the plasmic double. Grief is a necessary exercise of the plasmic double. How's that so? Well, when you are connected in love and destiny with another human being, another human animal on this planet, let me rephrase it more clearly. When two human animals on the earth are connected by a powerful bonds of love and destiny, and their lives are woven into the same vein of beauty, into one single and intact vein of beauty. And one of those animals is taken away. This is a very, very old, ancient, recurrent theme in Celtic legend and mythology. When one of those animals is taken away, the other animal must grieve. And you don't grieve just because of the loss. You grieve because it's necessary to keep on living. There is an occult side effect of the death of a loved one. And the side effect is all the more powerful as the love is powerful. So the love between Jan and myself, being mutual and being the first love for either of us, was extremely powerful. And when the loved one dies, it impacts the plasmic double. I'll just give it to you as I see it. That loss impacts the plasmic double. And the tendency at that point of the double is that it wants to merge into the physical body. But that is certain death. The double cannot merge with the physical body, as the physical body will die from the intensity of the presence of the double. The relation between the physical body, your physical body, and your plasmic double is a continual dance of approaching and retracting, but never fusion, never unification with the double. Unification with the double is death. So when Jan died, there was a tremendous tendency for my double to want to unite with my physical body. This is a mysterious event in the dynamics of the plasmic double. And the reason why you grieve is to prevent that from happening. So you must grieve consciously, knowing what you're doing. You must grieve aloud, and you must grieve in whatever degree of violent emotional catharsis is required. And in my case, it was extreme. And so when I passed the afternoons and evenings tucked away from the torrential rains of 1999, in the year 2000, in the south of France, when I passed day by day in that little hut with a wood stove burning, I underwent many, many moments of violent and intense catharsis of grief, and I mean screaming, sobbing. As you see in the culture of many native peoples who make their act of grief known by screaming and who make their act of grief a public event in some cases. Well, in my case, it was obviously not public, but it was most certainly and dramatically an external event. And I had so much grief to release that it took a while. It took a while. And in pouring that grief out, I did the counterpart against the tendency of my plasmic double to merge in my physical body. So there's an occult explanation, if you like, of why it's necessary to grieve. This is a story of the plasmic double, and stories of the plasmic double are what sorcerers tell at night when they're huddled under their shawls in the twilight, the crack between the worlds, listening to the trees breathe and tracking the paths that bats make in the air. To conclude that little digression, I'd like to say that my experiences with Jan since she died have often been deeply poignant and sad, but I feel always a growing and enduring joy knowing that she is there. She's certainly a constant presence in my life and in this house from which I speak right now. A constant presence, and I feel particularly on this anniversary a kind of joy I haven't felt before. It's a joy combined with confidence. As I said in the previous briefing, the sense of euphoria that comes from being on Channel 16 also carries a sense of tremendous confidence. And this confidence, let's say, we'll call it, for lack of a better term, a spiritual confidence. Confidence is not blind faith. Confidence is not magical thinking. It's not wishing that things could be that way and then pretending as if they are. No, confidence is like when you know how to drive a car, or when you know how to sail a boat. You sail out of the harbor in your little sailboat, and you have confidence that you can navigate. Confidence is based on knowledge and the fruits of experience. So I have confidence now about the fact that we both die and do not die. And I also have confidence about this new theme of our experiment, the theme of cooperating freedom. Cooperating freedom. I think you could say in a way that it was Jan, who first gave me the opportunity to experience this. I have freedom today, material freedom. And it's not just because of something that I receive materially through Jan, but it's because Jan was resolute and Jan made a resolution for my freedom. I want you to get the nuance there. The resolution she made for my freedom. And in the freedom so resolved, I teach and transmit the Gaia Navigation Experiment. So you may as well at some point, if you are so inclined, also thank my beautiful and incomparable friend, Jan. We learn by example, and we learn by what life gives us directly in the form of opportunities and challenges. What do I mean by cooperating freedom? And what does this have to do with the group telepathic experiment on Channel 16? Well, I'll tell you, it has a lot to do with it, my friends, a lot. You know, there's a paradox of freedom. I would state it in this way. This is the paradox of freedom, according to John Lash. A certain French writer named Cioran was a funny guy who lived in some apartment in Paris and wrote journals, and he was kind of like a post-existentialist, cynical philosopher. And he said, "La liberté ne se partage pas." Freedom cannot be shared. This is what he said. This is an exact translation. And I was always troubled by that little saying of Cioran, because I knew that it was a half-truth. Now, it's true that freedom cannot be shared. Let's say that you and I take a walk on the beach together. We're walking along. We have our feet in the water. We're observing the sky, the line of the sea, the birds. And I'm free to be there and take that walk by myself. And you're free to be there and take that walk by yourself. And if we take the walk together, it doesn't mean that we share the freedom to take the walk, does it? It simply means that we share the walk. That's the first half of the paradox of freedom. La liberté ne se partage pas. But now comes the second half. And this is where Channel 16 plays a role. Suppose that the freedom that you have to live your life, although you can't share it with anyone else really, suppose that it's just not meant for you alone. Now there's a paradox. You have something that you can't share, namely freedom, but it's not meant for you alone to hold. Now, contemplate this proposition for a moment. I think you can all get the first part. I think anyone can get what Cioran was saying. Sure, that's an existentialist remark that you can savor like a sour lemon ball that you stick in the corner of your mouth and suck on all afternoon. But the second half of the proposition, that's another story. Now let's just step back and take a look at this notion that your freedom as a human animal living in the divine experiment of the Aeon Sophia is not intended for you alone according to the parameters of that experiment. This is a high Gaian tantric teaching, and I never thought of it until the moment it came out of my mouth. Now, how could it be otherwise if freedom cannot be shared? That it must in some way be imparted or shared. How can it be otherwise? Now you might see here, as I develop this proposition spontaneously. It developing itself as I'm speaking. I've never talked about this before. You might see how this concept is converging on a point which can be defined as resolution or cooperating freedom. What is cooperating freedom? It is the freedom of the human animal that cooperates with the behavior of other animals. It's what, in a sense, you could say Kropotkin was on to at the time when Darwin became elevated as the demagogical prophet of the predators. Kropotkin, who proposed the idea of mutual aid from his observations of animal life, and who completely refuted the idea of survival of the fittest. Mutual aid is another way of talking about cooperating freedom. Suppose, for example, I live in a marina on a little sailboat, and the time has come for me to dry dock my little boat and work on it. And there's a lot of work to do, as you know, the upkeep of a sailing vessel is enormous. So there are the lines, the paint, the anti-rust procedures, caulking the hull, all these things. Now, I can't do all this by myself, so I put out the call to half a dozen of you faithful crew members, and you come on over, and you all climb aboard my little sailboat, my little home where I live, and you undertake different tasks. Now, you're all there voluntarily. You're all there in an act of freedom, an act of individual freedom. And when you undertake a task, you do so also in complete freedom, voluntarily. You decide that you're going to occupy yourself with the galley and repairing certain things in the galley and putting it in order. You decide that voluntarily. That is your resolution. You're acting in freedom, just as the other people who are assisting, helping me to get my little ship in order are all acting in freedom. But because you're acting in a common resolution on the same project, that becomes a cooperating freedom. Therefore, even without having to coordinate each other, all that you're doing from individual freedom coordinates and cooperates due to a mutual resolution. This is how communities are built. This is how everything is done, not only by human animals, but by other animals as well. So what's so new here? What's so surprising? Am I just describing, using language, perhaps over-elaborating the obvious? I don't think so. I don't think so. Because there is one particular factor in this kind of activity that now comes to light. One particular factor that becomes vivid in the context of Channel 16. In the language of the Nahuals, this factor is called the passage of command. And the passage of command is a deeply mysterious act of planetary shamanism. There are various episodes in Carlos Castaneda concerning Don Juan and Don Janeiro which allude to the passage of command. And there are numerous times you may recall when those two elder veteran shamans tell Carlos, much to his perplexity and sometimes to his anxiety, they tell him that they are going to pass on in some way. their power and their knowledge to him. But the passage of command is more than just a transference of knowledge, and even more than just a transference of power. It's a transference of command. Now I put it to you that we have reached a point in the Gaia navigation experiment, a little beyond the midpoint, when the advanced and sophisticated techniques of telestic shamanism come into play, if we are to complete this experiment according to our mutual resolution. So excuse me if I'm wearing different hats here. You know, principally I wear three hats, right? The Turton hat, the Nahual hat, which is big and black and has a big wide rim. The old Dugpa hat. And the navigator hat. Okay, so I'm mixing these roles, and I need to mix these roles. I can no longer separate them in the context of this moment in our experiment. Now, you may wonder where I'm going with all this. I may have lost you. I don't know. I mean, this seems to be kind of a far out course to take in order to talk about our experiment. But you know, this is where I'm coming from, and I have to talk from where I'm at. I just don't teach what I already know, although in some cases I do, but I teach what I am learning in the course of learning it. And I've learned some things in telestic shamanism that I have not been able to pass on to anyone. But now I see the moment has come to do just that. And since I've got your ear, you're the ones that are passing it on to, like it or not. When I received the term of Gaia Awakening here in Andalusia in the summer of 2008, I found many vulture feathers in the hills. And I would walk up there in the hills above my house or around Infinity Ridge and make my way through the brambles and the thorn bushes, which are totally vicious in this part of the world. And occasionally I'd look down, and right there in front of me would be an eagle feather or a vulture feather, more usually a vulture feather. Just want to say that vultures are the guardians of this place. My guardian Kali has the Nirmanakaya form of a vulture. That is her Nirmanakaya body in Tibetan terms. And vultures are friends and allies and guardians to Gaian shamans. Eagles also. And I've noted eagles coming around lately since Ambergane House was discovered. And in fact, I've seen eagles flying over Ambergane House, which is extraordinary omen, because eagles protect the community and the tribe, while vultures protect the shamans and warriors of the tribe. So I found vulture feathers, a lot of them. And I understood at that time that each feather was a command. A vulture feather is a command of the Dakinis. But what is a command of the Dakinis? You know, if there is to be a reality shift that brings this experiment on Earth back into the right direction as intended by the Divine Sophia and corrects the errors in the experiment, if there is to be such a shift, then it has to be a paradigm shift, obviously. It has to involve a paradigm shift. You know this cliche, paradigm shift. So let's consider, what is the paradigm that defines the problem? What is the paradigm that defines what is wrong with the human social order and works against the experiment? That paradigm is the paradigm of domination. The simple fact that some human animals wish to dominate others. They wish to impede on their freedom or deny their freedom. And that is wrong. That is absolutely and essentially wrong according to the founding parameters of this experiment. Human animals must absolutely respect the freedom of other human animals. That is sacred. Those who violate that respect and seek to dominate others are acting against the experiment. So we can say that the paradigm of evil, the paradigm of dysfunction, if you will, can be labeled domination. Those who wish to dominate are ruining the opportunities of the experiment for all others who don't have that drive to dominate. Now I propose to you that the counterpart and resolution of domination is command. Command is the supremely liberating concept of Gayan Tantra. Command. You really see into the psychology of the predators and the dominators and the globalists when you realize that they do not command the power that they wish to execute. The difference between an authentic human being and a fraud is that a fraud appears to have power over others, but does not in fact directly command any power. Whereas an authentic human being only possesses the power which he or she actually commands. So this word command is a fascinating word. The passage of command is a high attainment in Telestic Shamanism, and learning the passage of command is what I would endeavor to do now, to learn it to you, as it were, as I understand it. And the understanding of the passage of command was given to me 4 years ago by Vivi herself, around the time that I received her secret Dakini name. Now, there are things I could say about command and the commanding the powers of the Dakinis right now that I'm not going to say. Not because I'm holding them back or I want to tease you or put your panties in a twist, but simply because I choose to say them in a particular way at a particular moment. But let me assure you that as we proceed with this experiment of Channel 16, your own resolution will show you what I mean by the word command. And when you see what I mean by the word command, you will realize that you have never understood the word command. That's when you know you got it. Crudely speaking, we use the words command to command something. You know, I go into a deli and I command, you know, a pastrami sandwich on rye, you know. Or the President of the United States commands the army to go to war. These are completely delusional and archontic notions of command. Command is what you receive through Channel 16 and also what you implement through Channel 16. Channel 16 the aeonic connection of the earth to the pleromic center is a channel of command. Two ways. You receive it and you implement or practice or demonstrate. You demonstrate command. I'm here to tell you that you have never in your life until this moment demonstrated command, as I understand what that means. And how can I say that with such assurance? Because the only way that you can possibly know how to demonstrate command is in the framework of the Gayan Planetary Tantra and using the Shakti cluster. It is an extraordinary, paranormal, transpersonal, and supernatural demonstration. And that's where this experiment is taking us. So apart from whatever else we might be doing with Channel 16, I wanted to give you that view of the course ahead and whet your appetite for some of the things to come. Now let me see if I can drop back a few steps and tune down the volume a little bit to talk in somewhat more practical and user-friendly terms about what we're doing with Channel 16. Let's recall that the procedure for using Channel 16 is simple, it's elementary, and it's threefold. Use the call sign, GNE 516, to get on the channel. Then you transmit through the channel simultaneously a verbal and nonverbal message. You use an image, which is nonverbal, visual, and you use a verbal formula. Implicit in this primary rule is that the verbal formula is a formula of resolution, a message of intent. Let me repeat that there are five aspects, components, or facets to resolution as it operates through Channel 16. One, it means solution. The answer to a problem, the way to overcome a problem. Two, it means ending, resolution, the complete ending of a cycle of behavior, the complete ending of a particular mindset or attitude or belief system. Three, it means the specific commitment to do something, a New Year's resolution. Four, it means the focus and clarity of an image, as in the resolution of a photograph. Five, it means the general sense of determination. That animal has resolution. That animal has an embodied power of will and determination. That is a detectable quality when you encounter someone. By contrast to resolution, there is irresolution. And I would introduce the word irresolution to you as a descriptive formula. In fact, I'll expand the formula in just a minute here. A descriptive formula for the behavior of human animals who don't have resolution. If you don't have resolution, then you live in irresolution. And it's even worse than that. I'm talking now about the behavior of the human herd of animals. You know, there are principally two kinds of behaviors, three kinds really, among the human herd of animals. We can observe three types of behavior. One is the herd behavior, or the collective behavior, as we see in a mass migration of caribou. We see mass collective behaviors in the human herd. Secondarily, we see the behavior of bands, troops, clans, prides, that is to say, tribes and clans of human animals, smaller groups who are banded together for territorial reasons, usually. A pack of wolves is an example of the banding of human animals into a tight group. Kalikas are sort of like a band of wolves. Sorcerer's party is like a band of wolves, or pride of lions. And finally, you have the solitary animals, the ones who are very, very solitary. You see many examples of this, or you see most of the examples of this among the great cats, like the snow leopard of the Himalayas, the Andean puma. Magnificent predators spend a great deal of their time alone. So we see those three behaviors. And in those three types of behavior, let's return to the first type. That would be the herd or collective behavior. Now, there's a lot to be said about human animals behaving as a herd. And that would be the operative syntax of Gaian ethics, in fact, which is something that, as you know, I'm intent on developing in the next, in now and in the immediate future. Now, in this herd behavior, you can observe one extremely prevalent trait, and that is irresolution. Human beings have irresolution, and the main form that irresolution, the main symptom of irresolution is conformity. Human beings at the herd level conform to whatever is presented to them. They conform so easily, and they will conform to the worst conditions, whatever. They will conform to anything. They will conform to illusions. They will conform to advertising slogans. They will conform to political banalities pronounced by completely idiotic people. They will conform to fashion. They will conform to musical tastes. And why do they conform so easily, these animals of the human herd? It's because they live in irresolution. The more resolution you have, the less you conform. It's a simple and reliable formula. Now, I'd go even further to elaborate this formula. And I would say that not only does the massive herd of humanity live in irresolution, not knowing that they are free and not operating autonomously within their freedom, but they live in the contagion of irresolution. The contagion of irresolution is what dominates the behavior of the vast majority of human animals. That is to say that waves sweep through the herd, just in the way that they do in the African plains and in the Serengeti. In any place in the world where you see large herds of animals or birds like flamingos flocking around a lake in Africa, you see all these flamingos standing there. And then suddenly there's a sign, there's a signal, there's a sound, there's an event, and a ripple goes through the entire flock of flamingos at the same time. That is the contagion of irresolution. And human beings behave exactly as do these animals. There is absolutely no difference. And we cannot understand the behavior of human beings, human animals, unless we practice ethology and we compare them in this way. The popular delusions, the wars, the madness, the acts in which massive numbers of human populations get swept into events that are entirely contrary to their own well-being and even to common sense. All of this is due to the power of contagion. The power of contagion operates in the human herd as long as a human animal has not reached resolution. When you live in resolution, you separate yourself from the herd. I hope this picture is clear. Now, what are we going to do with channel 16? We're going to experiment in telepathic communication. I would like to go into details on how we're going to do that, and I will in the next few briefings. We'll set up these experiments. I'm open to hear your ideas about how to proceed with the experiment. And so I'll be looking at the forum that's been set up for discussing Channel 16. But for right now, in the initial conditions of the Channel 16 project, I want to impress on you our objective is not merely telepathic messaging, but it is the transference of our resolution. Now just think about this. Go back to this picture of the herd. The human herd rushes into World War III. The human herd rushes into the war on terrorism. It rushes into the TSA, the theater of sadistic absurdity, where people are going to airports and pretending that they are terrorists so that other people who are pretending that they might be terrorists can grope them and put them through grotesque machines. And the power of pretending creates, when it is not mastered, when it is not realized and mastered, the power of pretending creates this thing I'm calling the contagion. So we know how powerful this contagion can be because it sweeps all of those human animals who are irresolute into the spell of whatever is operating in that contagion. Whatever popular delusion or whatever malicious and malevolent agenda is being propagated through that contagion sweeps through the entire herd. Now just imagine that you would like to do something about that. That you would like to prevent the herd, the collective herd. Imagine that you are an animal of resolution. And you would like to prevent the herd of human animals from being swept into these horrific behaviors of contagion. How are you going to do that? Are you going to go out and stand on a soapbox and shout to them from the street corner? Are you going to start a movement? Are you going to write a book? Are you going to make a film? Are you going to write a song that encourages them not to conform, as Bob Dylan did many years ago, as Joan Baez did. Are you going to do all these things? Are you sitting around in your room thinking about all the things you're going to do that you'd like to do to counteract this horrific behavior of contagion in the human herd? Well, there are many valuable things one could do, and I wouldn't discount them. If you have the means and opportunity to make films, I would say that's the place to do it, because that is the medium of art that most powerfully impacts the collective imagination. But let's just suppose that you could impact the human herd by using a certain instrument provided by the divine Sophia herself and supported and implemented by the Pleromic Eons. Suppose that they provided you as a resolute animal with an instrument for transferring your freedom to those who are not free. That would be a way to share your freedom. Because your freedom that you realize as a human animal in this experiment is not meant for you alone. There's always a surplus in your freedom. There's always more to it than you can realize in the framework of your own individual life, isn't there? So, what I'm proposing to you is that the messages, the telepathic messages we send through Channel 16, all have the same objective. They all have the same purpose at base. And that purpose is to transmit into the collective a resolution that we hold in freedom that has not yet reached those who are irresolute and unfree. So the potential to operate on the collective mindset and on the behavior of the human herd through Channel 16 is something that you cannot reckon at this point. But I feel that I can say with confidence that that potential is high. Now, I'd like to describe another observation that I had on the 5th of October as I was talking with Jill and we were operating on Channel 16 together. I realized that the channel, particularly the central coil, which you can imagine represented by Jupiter at the pivot of the upper armature, the central coil behaves in a certain way when it receives the transmission of the message of intent from human subjects. So imagine that there you are, wherever you may be, in your home or out in nature, you are subvocally sending out a beam, as it were. You're sending out a signal from your throat, a beam, and this beam is going to Jupiter. And Jupiter might be envisioned as a copper coil in the form of an elaborate spiral. The copper coil has a loop at the top, and then it unfolds in a spiral fashion to form a sort of cone shape until it reaches the last coil. It's a cone-shaped coil device. And when the signal that you are transmitting on a telepathic beam of intention reaches that coil, three reactions occur in the coil. This is what I observed. And to the best of my ability, I can describe these reactions in this way. First, there is a reflux action. That is to say that the coil vibrates. Imagine this dangling, spiral-shaped coil vibrating from the impact of your telepathic signal. The first vibration is a reflux. It returns the signal to you, but amplifies it. So the first function of the coil, the transducer coil, is to amplify and magnify your own resolution as expressed in the signal you send to the coil. How wonderful is that? Along with that feeling of amplification comes confidence and euphoria. Also a feeling of ease, a feeling of being in command, if I might use that term. Second effect is that the coil vibrates along the length of the unwinding and widening spiral. And that is what I'll call a surflux response. In other words, the signal that you send into the coil not only bounces back to you amplified, but it amplifies itself through the spiral structure of the coil and radiates out from there. And that is the way that it reaches the collective mind subliminally. There's a surflux. You put in, say, a quantity of the order of 10 into the coil by your resolution, and a quantity of the order or 100 of or 1,000 of the same resolution vibrates from the coil in a manner in which an electromagnetic wave propagates itself, that is to say, at right angles to the direction of propagation. And so it proceeds through all of the windings of the coil, vibrating, picture this, vibrating delicately, a golden coil golden copper coil, a coil of electrum, which is an amalgam of silver and gold, vibrating intensely and radiating out at high amplification the signal input that you provide to channel 16. Finally, there is a third relay effect. Bear in mind that in the second effect, your resolution is broadcast into the subliminal mind of the entire human herd. But lo and behold, there are some animals in the human herd who are doing the same thing that you're doing. There are some animals who are with you in resolution on channel 16 using the call signal GNE 516 at the same time. And therefore, the surflux effect goes specifically to those other animals. And it unites them in their freedom. It puts them in cooperating freedom with each other, no matter where they are located in time and space. I'm telling you, I think you already know this, and I've suggested this before, that I'm teaching you how to use channel 16 as I learn how to use it myself. And there are things you can teach me about it as well in the course of the next few months. And as we all learn together, we are a group of human animals in the Gaia Navigation Experiment who are preparing ourselves for impeccable and infallible communication, even if the global telecommunication system goes down. It may go down, it may not go down. But as they say, you know, prepare for the worst. Actually, it would be a great thing if the global telecommunications system goes down and we lose the internet. In many ways, it would be wonderful. It would have many wonderful effects. It would also have many catastrophic effects. But regardless of what speculations we might have about that event or how it's connected with the exit of Mantis and so forth and so on, regardless of all that, the purpose of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, one purpose, one objective, is to learn how to have a backup system. And Channel 16 is that backup system. And I feel really confident and tremendously excited about this. Because now that it's taking form, now that it's coming into syntax and coming into conceptual definition, I am absolutely certain that this will work. Absolutely certain. I've never been more confident about anything in all of my career of shamanism and mythology and teaching what I learn. So I'm going to leave it at that. For now, concluding Nav Briefing 32. And in doing so, I just want to reiterate or restate the syntax of the message of intent for test one of channel 16. Reading from the crew notes. We transmit the message of intent corresponding to the image of the dance with Bandarias. And we do it in this syntax. In this simulcast on channel 16, our message of intent is to match and blend the male and female aspects of divine imagination so that it reaches a crescendo expression of complicity in Sophia's dreaming for each and every one of us. End quote. That's the message of intent for the initial conditions of the Channel 16 project. I have more to say about that. I want to unwind it, unfold it, deconstruct it, and look at it carefully in the next briefing under the title Command and Consent. So on that note, I'll leave you in the confidence and the euphoria that I feel, and wish you all safe passage.